There are a number of iconic elements that make up New York City: the Empire State Building, Times Square, Rockefeller Center, the Statue of Liberty. But long before these landmarks could come to define the big city, its very structure had to be developed. The new book, City on a Grid: How New York Became New York, tells just that story. How New York City's streets came to form the rectilinear grid that millions of people now walk through every day. Gerard Capel is the author of Bond of Union, Building the Erie Canal and the American Empire, and Water for Gotham, A History. His writing about New York City appears in numerous books, reference works, newspapers, journals, museum exhibits, and historical signage at city parks. We began our conversation by discussing how he came to the subject of the city on a grid.
How I got started with it. Well, yes. You know, it's actually a long story. I've been thinking about it for a while. Really only started writing the book, a couple of years ago. But started thinking about it after 9/11, if we can go all the way that far back. There was an intersection in old New York at the corner of Greenwich and Dey Streets in downtown part of the city, where in 1810... a painting was made depicting really my favorite corner of old New York, a depiction of a woman helping a child get water from a corner street pump, a water pump. And it's a beautiful illustration of just what life was like on a December day in 1810. And I actually used that image in a previous book of mine on the history of water in New York. In any case, I had never seen that intersection, because in the 1960s, the World Trade Center was built, the first World Trade Center, with a very large footprint that obliterated that intersection. The intersection of Greenwich and Dey didn't exist until in the aftermath of 9/11, when we now have a smaller World Trade Center footprint, and lo and behold, that intersection of Greenwich and Dey has returned. You can now stand in the place where a woman helped her child get water from a street pump in 1810. And that got me thinking, maybe the street organization of Manhattan is a little more plastic than we imagine it to be. Street corners can come and go and come back again. And that corner, way down in downtown, actually isn't on the grid. So I started thinking, okay, well, let's say, a little morbidly perhaps, let's say the Target on 9/11, or in some other manner, the Empire State Building was involved, not down at a relatively remote corner of the island of Manhattan, but in its emotional and especially physical center. So let's say the Empire State Building comes down. It doesn't come down straight. It flops over on its side, okay, and it takes out, X number of blocks. And those blocks have to be rebuilt. Do we rebuild them? Would we rebuild them exactly as they had been planned and built with the grid plan of 1811, this rectilinear pattern with parallel streets going across and parallel avenues crossing them at 90-degree angles? Or would we rebuild with something more conducive to modern transportation? More diagonals, more circles to keep traffic moving, more green space in sort of a post-industrial, now a post-industrial city, where green is good, and New York doesn't have very much green. And that's what got me started thinking about the book, and then sort of delving into the history of how the grid came to be and its long life now for about 200 years.
One of the things that you point out is, yes, this has been around for 200 years, but at the time, even as it was proposed, the rectilinear city grid system, it was not new. It had been used elsewhere. What made this different is its enormity.
So the grid goes all the way back to the Greeks, and it's been used all around the world ever since. But the grid of Manhattan is unique in its uniformity. Manhattan, under the plan of 1811, is essentially covered in a single, originally intended, unbroken grid. Central Park, not in the original plan. Broadway, which cuts at a diagonal through the grid, not in the original plan. A very unique piece of city planning with lots of different opinions about it.
When it comes to a grid system, what works and what doesn't work?
Well, that's sort of the eternal question. We can go all the way back to Aristotle, that he believed that beauty was essential to any town plan. Even if it was on a grid, there had to be some element of civic or urban beauty in it, meaning something breaking up the a relentless rectilinearity. The Spanish, who built colonial cities all throughout South America and even up into what is now but what was then Spanish colonial territory, Albuquerque, Santa Fe, even Los Angeles, were founded as Spanish colonial cities. They had grids, but the center of that grid was a very formal park, which was used for the siting of official and religious buildings around the edges of that central square. Those things would be nice to have here, something like that. It might be nice to have diagonals. It might be nice to have circles, which move traffic easily. It might be nice to have back alleys where you can put deliveries and sanitation and siting for construction rather than putting everything on the streets.
One of the things that I found fascinating is that when the grid system in New York was to be executed, it had pretty smooth sailing, but they didn't worry about things like the hills and the ponds and the valleys. They just sort of just put all the grid over all that.
Well, you know, that's a funny thing, smooth sailing. The grid was planned by a commission, which was appointed in 1807. And I should say briefly that before 1807, New York City was the populated part of the city was pretty much confined to the southern tip of Manhattan. Below, you know, your listeners may know where Chambers Street is. It's pretty much downtown Manhattan. Not too many people lived up island. There were farms, there were country estates, there were little settlements. But basically, it was an island of rolling hills and rocky crags and deep valleys, with most of them with swamps at the bottom of them. It wasn't really conducive to a flat grid. But the commissioners who were appointed in 1807 came up with their plan in 1811. It was a state law passed in Albany. And that law actually gave the three commissioners absolute authority to come up with whatever plan they wanted, and whatever plan they came up with would be the plan. There would be no legal objection to it. And their 1811 plan basically just threw a grid over the island and pretty much ignored the hills and the valleys and figured that that would be worked out by someone else after their commission went out of commission when they issued their report in 1811.
And that's pretty much what happened, right? I mean, it then became somebody else's problem.
It basically became somebody else's problem. Their chief surveyor for the three commissioners was a guy named John Randall. He was from Albany. I should note that he was connected to one of the three commissioners, Simon DeWitt, who was a great Albany personality. He was for 50 years the state surveyor general of New York. He did much to transform the state from a wilderness into a settled and place and economic power. But Randall, after essentially making this very generic map for the commissioners in 1811, was then hired by the city to make maps that would actually be a guideline for how to put these streets in this very naturalistically varied place. And it took him 10 years to do that. He made incredibly detailed maps. So it was really not until about 1820 that there really was like an implementation plan for the 1811 plan.
You talk in the book about how politics really wasn't a part of this when it came to choosing the grid system itself, although politics certainly had a play when the grid was being decided upon.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. In 1807, when the commissioners were appointed, the city government had pretty much been taken over by Democratic Republicans, which are like Jeffersonians, let's say, Aaron Burr, chief Democratic Republican in New York. But for 1 year in 1807, in early 1807, Federalists, which were the old party, regain control of the of state government. There was a lot of flip-flopping. Federalists were pretty much done, but for 1 year they got control, and it was under that common council, now the city council, but under that common council that the 1807 commissioners were appointed, meaning the city said, okay, it's time to make a plan. We're going to have Albany pass a law, and we want these three guys appointed as commissioners, all of them Federalists. And probably if the Federalists don't have that one-year renaissance in 1807, we may not get a commission appointed in 1807 to come up with the plan that we have now.
Are there places that you can get an idea of the landscape, what it was like at that time before the grid, where the hills and the streams were still there?
Yeah, you pretty much, well, the streams are all there. When we're all gone, however we go away, the streams will come back. They're just waiting. But you can see today in the northern parts of the island somewhat of the way the island looked like originally before the grid. The commissioners who came up with their plan in 1811 were given authority to plan the entire island from a southern baseline at what is now Houston Street, sort of the lower edge of Greenwich Village, if your listeners have some sense of Manhattan.
Sure.
But the commissioners were given authority to go all the way up to the northern tip of the island. Well, they quit at 155th Street because they said, you know what, above 150, what we're calling 155th Street, nobody's going to live there for centuries. And anyway, it's so rocky and hilly that we can't imagine, you know, it being gridded. Well, eventually, in the later 1800s, a street plan was put down in that upper section of Manhattan, and it is much more naturalistic than the grid that's on the rest of the island, because the planners then recognized that, listen, we got a hilly place here. It's actually somewhat beautiful, and we're going to run a lot of the streets along natural contours rather than obliterating them. And so you do pick up some sense of what Manhattan was like before we started making it a place of concrete and glass up in the upper reaches of Manhattan.
We talked about the pluses and minuses to a grid system, and as we wrap up, I'm interested in what New York and how, I mean, the subtitle of the book is How New York Became New York. So it's your theory that the reason that New York has worked so successfully as a city is partially because of that grid system.
Well, first of all, I have to say the title is mine, City on a Grid, which is meant to recall, you know, Boston as which is conceived as City on a Hill. I don't know if people will pick that up, but there's a
sure
brief mention of that in the book.
Yep.
But the subtitle was actually created by the editorial people at my publisher, How New York Became New York. I had something a little more complex. And I thought, my God, isn't that kind of making a grand statement for this thing, you know, that the grid is actually responsible for this? But, you know, now that the book is out, I've actually come to like it. And because it really goes to the question, I think, of, you know, what is the relationship between the grid and this incredible, powerful, orderly city that's developed here? You know, did the grid in its creation help make New York a powerful place or lead to New York becoming a powerful place? Or was it going to be anyway, no matter what plan was come up with, but with that grid plan in place actually helped New York become the powerful place it was going to become anyway? I'm not sure. There's a it's kind of a chicken and egg thing. But I think it's a good thing. It's something I always think about.
The name of the book, City on a Grid, How New York Became New York. It is published by DeCapo. Gerard Capel, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Joe, thank you.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, City on a Grid. It's published by DeCapo. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.